Hello there. Today is Wednesday, February 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the Palestinian leader calls for a new international effort at peace talks with Israel.
What we have here is not negotiations, but negotiating about the negotiations, and that's going nowhere.
Cape Town's water crisis underscores a deep inequality. A very deadly flu season continues. Also ahead, a power celebrity couple makes a huge donation to Florida students fighting for gun control. It's all on today's International Edition.
In a rare UN Security Council address, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas Tuesday called for an international peace conference to be convened by the middle of this year to try to break the impasse in the Middle East peace process. Palestinian leader expressed support for broad regional and international participation at such a meeting and laid out his vision in what he called a peace plan. The speech was the first time Abbas has addressed the 15-nation council since 2009. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Russell Stone, professor emeritus at American University's Center for Israel Studies, if he thought Abbas was able to actually advance the proposal.
I think what he advanced was confusion over the possibilities. The proposal that he advanced is a jumble of old and new multilateral and multi-country groups that overlaps in ways that make it very unclear what could come of his proposal.
Do you understand exactly what direction he's going? I mean, can you unpack some of the details?
Well, he's on the one hand reacting to the American move to recognize Jerusalem. On the basis of this, he's saying that the United States is no longer a viable mediator from his point of view. Therefore, he's suggesting other kinds of multilateral organizations and groups that could be put together as a mediating group. Of course, the immediate Israeli reaction to this is that they will only accept Israel as a mediator in the process. So it already creates a situation where there's non-starting. What we have here is not negotiations, but negotiating about the negotiations, and that's going nowhere. It's, if anything, reminiscent of the long debate at the end of the Vietnam War over the shape of the table at the Paris peace conferences, where that stalled the negotiation for months.
Is Mr. Abbas serious about the peace process, in your view?
It's hard to know. He maintains that he's serious about moving ahead with peace and that he supports a two-state solution, but the actions are that he refuses to negotiate directly with Israel or in anything but a very broad multilateral setting.
The French UN ambassador said Paris is open to studying his suggestions. The deputy British UN diplomat described U.S. leadership on the matter as indispensable.
Well, that's, again, you know, creating lines that will make agreement about the negotiations even more difficult. What this does is simply kick the can down the road in terms of actually getting to negotiations.
The U.S. Later declared that it was ready to talk with Mr. Abbas. Ambassador Haley said, "Our negotiators are sitting right behind me, ready to talk, but we will not chase after you. The choice, Mr. President," referring to Mr. Abbas, "is yours." Behind her was Jared Kushner, the U.S. Mideast envoy, Jason Greenblatt.
Yes, this is the United States supporting the Israeli position that they want the United States to take the lead as mediating the negotiations. On the other hand, we have to remember that the so-called American peace plan, while it's being dangled as existing, has not been revealed and was not revealed at the United Nations today.
Well, according to one report, Kushner and Greenblatt met with the 15 Security Council ambassadors behind closed doors after the public meeting on Tuesday. Secretary of State Tillerson last week said the Mideast plan was fairly well advanced, but we have no details.
That's correct. We have no details, so there's nothing to go on.
Mr. Netanyahu, in response to Mr. Abbas, said he's actually running away from peace. Does Mr. Netanyahu's own personal legal political problems have an impact on this process?
Undoubtedly. We don't know where where that is going in terms of the internal situation within Israel. But both sides have long claimed that the other side is not serious about negotiating.
Where do we go from here, sir?
I wish there could be optimism about it, but I guess as long as there's talk, there's attention to it. But in terms of moving the situation forward, nothing much is happening right now.
I guess the next step then would be wait for the U.S. plan to be unveiled.
Perhaps. I think the U.S. plan might not be unveiled for some time. It might even be the sort of plan that will not be unveiled until both sides buy into it. And I can't imagine that happening anytime soon.
All right, that's Russell Stone, Professor Emeritus at American University's Center for Israel Studies. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump denounces the women who accused him of sex abuse. Abbas calls for an international conference to restart Mideast peace. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya at risk from looming monsoons. And Oxfam is probing new sexual misconduct claims as a scandal engulfs the aid sector. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Special counsel probing Russian interference in the U.S. 2016 presidential election has unveiled charges against a lawyer for making false statements. The Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller has accused attorney Alex van der Zwaan of knowingly making materially false, fictitious, and fraudulent statements to investigators about a Ukraine-related case. VOA's Ken Breidemeyer spoke with International Edition's Sarah Williams about the case.
This all relates to the Russia probe into the Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. This is a tangent. It's related to the charges against Paul Manafort, who is a former Trump campaign manager, and his deputy, a man named Rick Gates. They were charged in connection with ahead of the election of Trump with money laundering violations linked to their lobbying efforts in Ukraine. Now, in this new case, van der Zwaan is accused of lying to federal investigators about his contacts with Gates and an unnamed person. Under U.S. law, this is called a criminal information, was filed last week.
And van der Zwaan apparently has a family connection to a Russian businessman.
That's right. He's the son-in-law of a Russian billionaire named German Khan. This lawyer worked in the London office of a prominent U.S. law firm named Skadden Arps. And they were hired to put together a report in 2012 about the trial of former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. That was a controversial trial at the time. A lot of Western interests assumed it was politically charged, instigated by former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. Tymoshenko was convicted of embezzlement and abuse of power and imprisoned. But by 2014, as Yanukovych was toppled, Tymoshenko was cleared of the charges, and she remains an activist in Ukraine today.
And as this case goes on, over the weekend there were reports, and I don't think anything's emerged yet, but that there might be, I guess, additional charges some sort of an agreement with Rick Gates, who is this deputy to Paul Manafort.
Robert Mueller's office has certainly been talking to Gates and his attorneys. No change in his status at this point, though. So the Mueller investigation, despite the fact that Trump's lawyers have frequently said that it would end soon, obviously is not ending.
VOA's Ken Breidemeyer reporting. The South African city of Cape Town is mired in a three-year drought and poised to become the world's first major city to run out of water. But they did receive some good news that it will now happen by July 9th. That's a month later than last forecast. But for many residents of the city's sprawling low-income townships, water has always been a rare commodity. As residents are being asked to conserve every drop, some say they can't tighten their belts much more. VOA's Anita Powell brings us this report from Cape Town.
Ever since she can remember, Pelikazi Rangana has treated water as a precious resource, and not by choice. She has never, in her 53 years, taken a shower. That is because her government-provided home in the impoverished Khayelitsha township does not have an indoor bathroom. For years, she says, she, her husband, child, and grandchild have bathed in the bedroom using a shallow bucket that holds about 8 liters of water. So the Cape Town resident says she's struggling to understand how some residents of this seaside town are chafing under tight new water restrictions.
It's been not sitting right because in a long time they were the ones who used the water. We are the ones who were not wasting the water. But now, it doesn't matter now if we were looking after water. Now it's all of us. We are in the same. Like now they are in our shoes.
Rangana's neighbor, Ntombikayi Sedondi, says the drought and water restrictions have hit her hard. She used to have a flourishing home garden. Now she is down to 3 wilted lines of spinach and some sad-looking cauliflower.
This garden makes me cry because I used to feed my family with this garden.
Scientists are still studying the cause of Cape Town's predicament, though they say climate change is a likely culprit for the drought. But the city is also unusually dependent on rainfall, relying on 3 rain-fed dams for all of its water. 3 dry years have almost depleted them. At several natural springs in the city, residents can still fill up water containers for free, up to 25 liters a person. When the city reaches day zero, the day the faucets will run dry, the city plans to set up 200 public water collection points.
We always used to just took water for granted. Now we know what it is to struggle.
That's 70-year-old Jean Gordon, who has lived in Cape Town all her life, near the lush Newlands area. She says she's had to make some unorthodox adjustments to cope.
Showerless, sharing the shower with the husband, and
But in poorer areas like Khayelitsha, where many residents have long relied on public taps, the parallels to the unfair apartheid regime are hard to ignore, says local activist and volunteer Mpumi Mkhlalisi.
The upcoming struggle now will not be a struggle for freedom, but be a struggle for water.
That is a message that haunts many Cape Townians as they face down day zero and an uncertain future. Anita Powell, VOA News, Cape Town.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, the flu season in the United States has been the worst in nearly a decade. At least 63 children have died, and the number is expected to go up. The viral strain causing the most illness this year, H3N2, brings especially severe illness and is hard to control with a vaccination. Joining us now to talk more about why it might be afflicting so many people so severely this year is veteran physician and evolutionary biologist Dr. Bill Miller. Thank you for being being with us, sir. It certainly seems pretty bad this year.
Certainly, this is a troubling flu season, clearly the most difficult for us as a society to handle since 2009. This is simply a more difficult than average flu season.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it is because each of the influenza viruses, there are different strains. The best way to think about it is as if they have differing personalities. Each of these influenza strains are a little bit different with respect to how quickly they can mutate, how quickly they can find ways around our own immune defenses. And it matters for the manufacturing of a vaccine, the effectiveness of it. And it also pertains to how quickly these particular strains, each are different, the way that they can jump from person to person. So the extent to which they can cause disease differ, and it differs from year to year, and it can differ from strain to strain.
So obviously that's why some years the flu vaccine works better than others, and it sounds like this year's is not really all that effective.
This year, the rough calculation of effectiveness is somewhere around 30%. Compared to a typically better match eaten year, that's about half of the typical effectiveness. But before anyone thinks that that's not a good reason to be vaccinated, 30% is a substantial number.
Right.
There's also carryover, because although the match may not be perfect to have you actually not get the flu at all, there's clear statistical evidence that those people who have been vaccinated are much better protected against really significant adverse outcomes from the flu, like hospitalization and pneumonia or death. So there are very strong reasons to be vaccinated this year, even though its effectiveness is not as great as in prior years.
Why is it that it seems like particularly deadly this year? We've just been hearing a lot about a lot of people, in particular children, dying quickly from this strain of flu.
The difference is that this strain of flu, its personality, as it were, and one of the things that about this particular strain, the way it has affected people that have been previously healthy, is different. It generally affects the opposite ends of the age spectrum, either the very young, toddlers, infants, that have not had a chance to build up the normal adaptive immunity that a healthy adult has, or it afflicts the elderly or those people that are immunocompromised. As we get older, as we age, our ability to combat infection diminishes. In the typical year, the flu tends to attack everybody, but the healthy population that gets the flu, they bounce back, and it's only complications only supervene on either ends of the population spectrum. But every once in a while, there can be a flu strain, and this year is one of them, in which, and these are reasons that we do not understand, for some reason this strain has the ability to overcome the defenses of a previously healthy person. Mm-hmm. I think this year seems worse than other years, not only because of the actual increase in the number of cases, but this particular strain has targeted young, healthy people in a way that, you know, we've seen the news report, a child is well, and then suddenly is dead of the flu.
Mm-hmm.
A person, a skier, or someone, a marathoner, perfectly well, and then a few days later, they're dead of the flu. And we don't believe in our modern era this should happen. But we still don't have all of the proper defenses that we hope to have someday to combat influenza.
Are we in the middle of flu season, or are we toward the tail end of it?
No, we're in the middle of flu season. It's not nearly too late to go ahead and be vaccinated. It takes a couple of weeks for the vaccine to really take hold, to really pump up your immune system. But we've got a couple of more months of the flu season at least. So, and there's no telling exactly when it's going to completely taper off. It's definitely not too late.
All right. That's veteran physician Dr. Bill Miller. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by VOA's Doug Bernard. Hi, Doug. What's happening today?
Well, there's certainly no shortage of news, it seems, lately. And it was really only a matter of days ago that we had that shooting down at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. It has not dropped off people's radar, and especially on social media. One of the biggest trenders is hashtag never again. Now, sadly, this is not new. This is a hashtag that has been floating around for years, and it's pulled out, you know, seemingly after every shooting that just sort of confounds the nation. I mean, you have a school shooting, never again. You have a shooting down at a nightclub in Florida, whoop, hashtag never again. You have a shooting in Las Vegas, kills 58 people, unbelievably, whoop, never again. Now, so And if you look back at how it has been used, it's a hashtag that never really seems to kind of advance anything. It's just really a hashtag that involves lots of squabbling, people making accusations against each other. You're trying to take my guns. No, you don't care about the safety of my child, that sort of thing. And then people just kind of throwing up their hands and saying, well, nothing can be done until, whoop, never again. I will say, I've been reading through a lot of these today, and I've noticed a difference, and I don't know if this will continue. A lot of the people who are using this hashtag today aren't adults. They're young people. They're people who are in high school or even middle school who themselves are concerned about this, want something to be done. And I'm seeing a lot more. Usually I sort of read through all the comments. I'm not going to do that now because I want to wait and see where this goes. But we're seeing a lot more positive comments, not positive about the shooting, of course, but positive comments in terms of the willingness and the belief that something somehow can be done to limit the number and the frequency of these shootings. Now, sadly, I mean, today as we speak, there was already a shooting in Ohio. One middle school student is dead. It wasn't a shooting anywhere as large as Marjorie Stone Douglas, but it was a shooting nonetheless. So hashtag never again, well, again. But I think it'll be interesting to watch and see where this goes, and if this begins perhaps in some way to kind of generate its own energy in terms of creating the willingness for needed change. I think it's just one we have to keep our eyes on.
All right, Doug, thank you. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, despite the horrific school shooting tragedy, we are seeing people rise to the occasion. As often is the case, the worst things possible often bring out the best in people. Joining us now is Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. Nicole, I understand there is a very high-profile celebrity power couple really stepping up.
So the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, have decided to march on Washington on March 24th to call for stricter gun control in our nation. They're calling it the March for Our Lives. And George and Amal Clooney were very, very inspired by these students' movements, and they've decided to donate $500,000 in support of the cause. George released a statement to E! News today. He said, Amal and I are so inspired by the courage and eloquence of these young men and women from Stoneman Douglas High School. Our family will be there on March 24th to stand side by side with these incredible generation of young people from all over the country. And in the name of our children, Ella and Alexander, we are donating $500,000 to help pay for this groundbreaking event. Our children's lives depend on it. So this is like amazing that they are not only going to donate money and just let these kids do what they need to do, they're going to be in Washington, D.C., at least
that
according to this statement, in just a few weeks.
Wow. You know, George Clooney's always been somewhat politically active, but to make this kind of donation and to make the decision to actually be there in support of these kids, heartwarming. This whole situation really hit home for you. You've got a relative that actually goes to that school.
Yes, my younger cousin is a freshman at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas down there in Parkland, and he was among the thousands of students who had to run for their lives last week when that shooter opened fire. And I saw him over the weekend, and he is okay. He did have two friends pass away during the incident and had another friend who was hospitalized. So it's been a very emotional time for him, but he said something that was so impactful to me. I said, are you scared? And he said, if I lived my life in fear, I would never leave my house. And coming from a 15-year-old, that just was like, you're too young to be saying something like that. So I think these kids really might try to do, they're going to do everything they can to make a change here in our country.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, we wish him all the best, and I'm so sorry for his loss and, you know, that he has to endure something like this at that age. You know, nobody at any age should really have to go through that. Let's turn to other Hollywood news now that doesn't involve such tragedy, except maybe on a personal level. You've got more insight on the recent news that we just heard that Jennifer Aniston and her husband, Justin Theroux, have split up and have actually been split up for a while, and it sounds like you're hearing more details about what actually happened.
Yeah, so they announced their separation last week, and a lot of fans were really upset because, you know, everybody wants Jennifer Aniston to have her happily ever after. And now that it's been a few days, sources are saying that there was actually trouble from pretty much the beginning, and a lot of friends were very surprised they even went through with their wedding because they seem so different. Jennifer likes living in Los Angeles, Justin likes being in New York, so the distance was a big, big problem for the two of them. A source close to them said that they fell in love hard and the passion was there and all of that, but they never really developed like, okay, maybe we'll stay on the East Coast together, and it seemed like they were always apart. I guess maybe some people thought they saw this coming. I saw a lot of buzz on Twitter last week about, well, Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt are both single again in 2018. Maybe there will be a reunion. Mm. But Brad Pitt's had his fair share of problems too. So a lot of diehard Jennifer Aniston fans were saying like, no, Brad Pitt is bad news. She's better off single for now. I think we're all rooting for her to have her a happy ending.
Oh, that was Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our director as well, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It will take years for Iraq to recover from the devastation caused by ISIS. The country has made tremendous strides forward, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson at the recent Kuwait Reconstruction Conference on Iraq. The government of Iraq rolled out its 10-year reconstruction and development framework, which complements its 10-year Vision 2030 and National Development Plan. It combines government reforms, anti-corruption programs, incentives for private sector development, and international contributions to effectively rebuild the Iraqi economy and identify sustainable long-term solutions to foster economic stability. The government of Iraq is taking steps to match actions with words to demonstrate that Iraq is open for business, creating meaningful improvements to Iraq's business environment and attracting much-needed investment for reconstruction projects across Iraq. The United States will maintain our bilateral relations with Iraq through the Strategic Framework Agreement, Secretary Tillerson said. To enable the defeat and stability in the wake of ISIS, the United States has contributed more than $2.2 billion for Iraq in economic and security assistance since 2014. The U.S. is currently finalizing the details on a second FMF loan to build on the historic gains these forces have made over the past 3 years. The Department of Defense announced an additional nearly $1 billion to further support, train, and equip Iraqi forces over the coming year. A healthy private sector is essential to creating the jobs and stability that are needed, and it will generate revenues necessary for reconstruction and needed investments in the health, security, and transportation sectors. Steps towards a stronger private sector will require tough decisions and perseverance, but they will pay off in the future, said Secretary of State Tillerson. To help jumpstart Iraq's economy, the United States extended to Iraq $3 billion worth of credit through the U.S. Export-Import Bank. At the same time, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation has 5 active projects worth $250 million in Iraq and is reviewing over $500 million worth of new proposals. Much work remains to rebuild Iraq and modernize its economy, said Secretary of State Tillerson. Helping Iraq create a government that is inclusive, accountable, and transparent will build a society that can counter the extremist ideologies. This will deal ISIS its final blow and demonstrate its failed violent ideology.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
from Washington.